So I'm just gonna ask you like some questions and
Okay.
So where in North Carolina are you based out of right now?
I'm in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. It's a small town like in the northeast part of North Carolina. So I'm like an hour or 2 hours from Raleigh.
Okay. And like not a lot of artists come from North Carolina. And I like to say
That's
that like
true.
even like fewer house artists like are from there. So how do you think that living there has impacted your approach to making music?
It's been really cool because like I feel like the genealogy of my musical influences is very like I don't know, it's really weird because like I get a little bit of the southern rap from Memphis and Texas and Atlanta, and then I get a little bit of like jazz because like Nina Simone is like she's from North Carolina and she's just incredible jazz musician, and then you get like a little bit of folk music. And it's like all these different genres from like different parts of the East Coast kind of mesh in a weird way in North Carolina. So it's been cool to like kind of see how that has impacted my musical development. Like I feel like my sound is unique for that reason. Like I have all those kind of amalgamations come together, which I can attribute to my experience growing up in North Carolina.
It's like the convergence of everything. And when did you first realize that you wanted to start being a producer?
It's only been like 2, 3 years, I think. I think it's coming up on 3.5 now. Like senior year of college, like June between junior and senior year of college. That summer in between, my friends were making a bunch of music. I was like, "Yo, I'm gonna start making music too, since all my friends are doing it." And then I picked it up on a whim. I started just making weird stuff for my friends and staying up all night in their apartments, just making weird electronic stuff, making weird ambient stuff. And then, like, as we got close to graduation, I was like, okay, I'm gonna start taking it kind of seriously, I guess, now that I'm getting pretty good at it. I started making my little house stuff. I was like, okay, yeah, I'll just do this for a while and see what happens. And here we are, 3 years later, I'm still burning CDs.
You're getting like quite a following though. So
Yeah, it's been nice. Like, I feel like it was kind of a transition because I feel like I built my online following mostly through, like, I don't know. I was an artist, but I wasn't really like producing a bunch of stuff. Like I did a comic for a while. Okay, that's a lie. I was doing a bunch of stuff. I did a comic for a little bit. I was doing illustrations. I was doing paintings. I was just doing a bunch of, pretty much whatever I could get my hands on while I was in college. And I feel like my following kind of built up because of that. And then just one day I was like, okay, guys, I'm gonna make music. And that's just how it happened. I'm grateful that my fan base, or my supporters rather, were able to cross over and support me in both ways.
And like a lot of people don't know this, but like you did like receive a Bachelor of like Fine Arts and Studio Art from NYU. So how did your time there help sort of guide your artistic direction?
Oh, it changed my life, dude. Like, oh, I can't say this enough. Like being like having the privilege to have a theoretical fine arts like time to study, like studying theory as opposed to like the actual practice of like can you draw an apple like realistically, like that's cool too. Like all the technical stuff is really cool, and to be able to like master your technical skills is also like that's a privilege too, to have it, to be in a space where you can do that. But to be able to engage with like critical art theory day in and day out for 4 years is like life changing. Like totally changed the way like I approach like the world, or the way I approach making objects, or making videos, music. It just, I don't know, exposed me to so much theory that like ties into my political theories also. So it was just like it changed my mindset in terms of how I want to, in terms of how I want to relate myself to my labor and the meaning of my objects when I put them out into the world. Like being able to like think critically about that for 4 years before I even like had a career. It put me in a good place mentally, I think, to where now I'm really conscious of like what I'm doing and the purpose behind it, and I have like a clear path, and like basically I know what the fuck I'm doing, like like I know what I'm doing. I'm a professional, and I can only say that because I had the time to stumble through theory and to stumble through learning what I want to get out of the artistic experience, and that was because of my time at NYU.
Facts. Facts. And before you became a house producer too, you were a civics and economics teacher.
I was.
So how do you think that shaped you as both a person and as an artist?
It's funny because teaching is one of those things that it's like probably the hardest thing I've done in my life. Like
Okay.
all things considered, I think teaching is probably the craziest, because it's like you have such a large impact on a developmental child over the course of a year, and that can like send them on a crazy trajectory that like you might never see the end of that path, but and you might not ever know like how your actions sent them along their life path. So it's like a lot of responsibility for somebody that's, you know, 23 years old. I'm teaching a bunch of kids who are only 10 years younger than me. I'm like, yo, I don't know. I don't know anything. So I don't know. Teaching, like, it made me reaffirm like my personal politics. Like, cause like from day two, like week two, I was like teaching like the difference between like socialism, communism, and capitalism. And I was like, yo, my agenda. I told them straight up. I was like, okay, look, I'm not the type of person where I can be in a teaching setting and be unbiased. But what I will do is address my bias, tell you why I'm biased, and then help you, you know, hold yourself and critique your own views versus mine and this and that. You know, just help them develop critical thinking skills. But I was like, you know, I had to really be on top of my stuff and figure out why I believe what I do, and then figure out what's the best method of teaching to where my bias is still a learning experience, but it doesn't like alter their basic understanding of the concept. I felt like that was like the hardest thing for me to do, but it also taught me a lot about myself, and taught me like how to like get the essence of my beliefs into like core fragments that I can like disperse to my students. I feel like that's also just a good tool for the average person to have, to like know exactly what you believe.
Yeah. You know, I kind of wish I had like someone young as my like economics professor, because like they're not teaching you about like a communism, socialism. Right. At all. They're always like, no, that's like all wrong. Like you have to learn the like traditional stuff.
Exactly.
And what was it like for you to work on your city's art council?
Yeah, that was like, I only did it for a while because I was only able to go to a few meetings, and then, you know, quarantine, everybody was quarantined. So I was only able to go to like maybe two or three meetings, but like to see, it just made me realize that there's so much that could be done in my town. And but it's just it's like, oh, it takes so much money. Everything takes so much money and like political power. I don't really have either of those, but I do have, I feel like, a decent degree of expertise. So I was trying to figure out, like, I guess, I think it gave me an experience to where, like, I think 10, 15 years from now, I'll be able to, like, take what I experienced then and kind of build on it. Because, like, it taught me that there was a lot of bureaucracy when it comes to making improvements to a city, which is, like, something I already knew, like, of course, but, like, to see it firsthand is, like, damn. We got a lot of work to do before we can really start to like change shit and get new programs and get new buildings. Like, it's definitely easy. It was easy for me as a young activist, I guess, to say like, I want these changes to be made. I want to do this. But then once you start doing it, it's like, oh man, this is gonna take forever, dude. Like, there's so many people who are old and white and rich in charge, and they have these like age old tendencies that you just can't break, and it's like, oh man, it sucks, dude. But I don't know, I think it made it like, it didn't depress me at all. It just made me realize that, okay, logistically, once I get older, I'm gonna have a lot of obstacles in my way that I have to figure out how to navigate, and it's gonna take a lot of political skills that I don't yet have.
It's like just that awareness can like help guide you in the future, so you know like how to like maneuver.
Exactly.
And you see, like the way that I originally found out about you was like through talking to one of my friends, like the external music director here at KCSB. Mm-hmm. And we're like talking about artists who value their music more than like the traditional $20 to $40 for like a standard 1 LP, 2 LP album.
Right.
There's Matt Comey, who's doing like $145 for like a 7-inch.
Yeah.
There's Rap Ferreira, who's doing like $77 for like Purple Moonlight Pages. But there's also you, who sells 24 karat gold CDs for like $45, 7-inch records for like $40. And what made you decide to take that approach when selling physicals?
Honestly, it's like when you put in that position where you have to do things on your own, you start to have a vastly different approach to how you value your labor, and how much money you think you should be earning from it. So like, I didn't really even care about, you know, the standard rates for CDs or vinyl, because it didn't apply to me, because most people aren't producing their own stuff, or, you know, going to independent vinyl cutters locally and getting them to cut their stuff. Like, you know, like I feel like I've had to take on a lot of responsibility personally and getting my stuff made and even make it. Like, I make my own CDs. I do that shit at home, you know, like, once when you've been burning CDs for hours and you've been waiting 3 months for some random guy in the mountains to cut your vinyls for you, like, it makes you wonder, like, damn, am I making enough money from this? Like,
no.
Are my prices okay? Like, am I going to be able to live off this? And the answer has been no for so long, like, that, like, you get to a point where it's like, okay, I have got to be able to live somehow off of this. My price has to go up, or it's just not going to make me feel okay with myself. And once I realized that, I was like, yeah, my price is gonna be whatever I needed to be, because I gotta make a living. And I always make that like my upfront statement. Like, yes, it's gonna cost this much. Yes, it's gonna take this long to produce. And that's just how things are until I get, you know, more resources and you know, ideally some sort of distribution deal. Until I get there, then this is what it is and this is what it has to be. And I think people appreciate that when you tell them up front, like, if my CD is gonna be $100, this is why. And you can either take it or leave it, but either way, it's gonna be $100.
No, there's so much you can do.
Yeah, it's only so much I can do. Like, as a living artist, like, what do you want from me? You want me to sell $5 CDs, 24 karat gold? Like, yeah. I can't do that. I'm sorry. You know?
No, so, I mean, you're not like pressing like 5,000. Like, you can't. Exactly. You don't have the price point to literally like let people pay like $20 for an LP. Right. It's not like,
and it's also like, it's not because I don't want to. Like, mm-hmm. if I could sell 24 karat gold CDs for $1 each, I would. I would do it. Yeah. I would give it away for free if I could, you know? Mm-hmm. But since I can't, it is what it is. Supply and demand, you know? What can I do about it?
Exactly. And, I mean, this kind of, like, goes into the next question. But, like I said earlier, like, I know you've been selling like, the CD box sets that you've been burning yourself at home in a completely DIY fashion. Mm-hmm. Now, what has that process taught you as, like, a fully independent artist who has to, like, do everything himself, like, without like a label, without really any like help?
It makes you pick up a lot of skills, whether it be people skills or just technical skills. Like, this is also where my art background came in handy, because I'm really good with my hands and making stuff, and I've had experience, you know, doing vinyl lettering. I worked at a print shop before, you know. I have any kind of thing you can think about making with your hands, I feel like I've done it in some way, shape, or form. So I have experience enough where I feel like I can recreate anything I see with my own two hands. And that makes me feel very confident and powerful. So when it comes to music stuff, it's like, it's just how many skills can you pick up? It's like, how wide can you expand your skill tree? I feel like that's what being an independent artist is all about. Like, you're gonna encounter things where like case in point, like when I was doing my Time Traveler vinyls, they emailed me like, yo, do you have like a barcode for your UPCs and IRSC codes for your tracks? And I was like, what? I was like, a barcode? ISRC? UPC? What is that? And like, luckily the music distributor I use, like, they keep all my stuff on an online portal where I can go and like and see if I need it. So that was, it wasn't an emergency, but I was like, yo, how do you make a barcode? Like, I had to Google like barcode generator for UPC codes. And like, I did the most like BS job on the barcodes, but you know, it worked out fine. But like, it's like little stuff like that that you never think of that you have to end up taking into account. Or like, I had to sign like a bunch of contracts to give them the rights to press my music. And since I had been using, independent cutters for so long, it was the first time where I was like, oh, I have to sign over the rights for you guys to press my yeah. vinyl for me. Like, I didn't know, didn't even know that was a thing. So it was like, you know, you pick up so many small things along the way that make it really worth it. Or like when I'm sourcing like cases or like discs and stuff, like, I'm a nerd, so you know, I'm always looking out for new discs or new types of CDs, new types of DVDs to use, new types of cases that nobody's using. And like, you start getting mad over really small stuff. Like, the price of my cases went up by 20 cents a box. And I was like, I was losing it. I was like, 20 cents? That's like, God. I was like, it's like $5 extra. I was pissed. So it's just a lot of little stuff that you end up navigating. I think that's both the hardest part and the most rewarding, because now I have a bunch of like behind the scenes experience. So that if I ever get to a point where I have to put the work on other people, then I understand fully like what I'm asking them to do. It gives me I keep saying this, but it's so true. Like, it gives you such a different perception of labor. Like, somebody was asking me like, why don't you just like start a record label and, you know, and get some other artists and start a label yourself? And I was like, no, this is so much responsibility. Like, even for one person, like, I would never want to put, like, I would never want my actions to affect another artist's career when I'm not ready for it, you know? Like, that's so much like responsibility and pressure that you, and you're affecting a whole other person's livelihood. So like, I can't just, I'm not comfortable just saying on a whim, I'm gonna start a record label. Like, no, that's a lot of responsibility. That's livelihoods at stake, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just, it makes you more appreciative when you're asking other people to do labor for you, when you fully experienced it, doing it on your own and for yourself.
True. And can you like talk a little bit about Gum Studio and how you're able to like jumpstart your own website that you could use, sell merch, release music through, and like essentially manage yourself?
Yeah. So it started out, it was just my name, like my first and last name.com. Mm-hmm. And once my music started getting a little bit more popular, I was like, oh man, I don't want my real name just, you know, everywhere. So I just came up, I was like, okay, I'll just change it to Gum Studio. We'll do gum.computer because nobody has the dot computer URL extension these days. I feel like that was pretty sick. So I was like, okay, let's do gum.computer. That's pretty dope. At first, it was just going to be a portfolio page. And I had like all my design work and stuff, like my cover art and whatnot. And then once I realized that Bandcamp had to, they take like 15% from your orders when you first start out, like until you sell, I think it's until you sell like $10,000 worth of merch, then they cut it down to 10%. But still, I was like, that 10%, yo, that's a lot of bread, yo. So I started selling like my C's and stuff, and like hazmat suits and all the other weird stuff. I started selling on my own web store, so I can kind of cut out the middleman, basically. I'm doing all of this over, you know, like $5 or $10 for each sale, but that's, it should add up, you know. Like, yeah, I don't want to have to keep paying those processing fees from Bandcamp. So anything I don't sell on, I figured anything I don't want to sell on Bandcamp, I can sell in my own store, so I can avoid the processing fees. And it's just turned into, you know, pretty much my online resume now. It has my, I do like a archive of all my past events, archive of any time I've appeared in any kind of written press. All my design work that I've done myself for all of my music, and it has a web store. So it's like a one-stop shop for everything about me, which I think is a pretty good tool for people to have. Even though I feel like Twitter, you know, is the way people know me or find out about me mainly. But the website is a good place to, like, if you want to know more about this guy, you know, is everything in one place, which has been, it helps a lot. And like, since I don't have a booking agent, I have to read all my emails individually, so like, it's hard because like, if I put my email in my bio, then I get 100 people sending me music and asking me to look at it. I'm like, yo, I'm not, I can't put you on. Like, I don't know what you want me to do. Like, I'm not even famous, dude. Or like, people send me beats. I'm like, I don't use other people's beats. I'm just not comfortable. I don't, you know, like.
It's like, I'm a producer. I'm not gonna like. There's nothing to do with this.
Yeah, like people think because I put out one rap album that I'm a rapper. I'm like, no. I got lucky. I did that one time. I can't do that again. I don't know. It's hard. It's hard, like. Creating boundaries online is such a like nuanced thing to do. Of course, I'm open to being contacted by people, but when it comes to, it's hard to separate like personal versus personal and business boundaries online, because even if you're really clear about it, sometimes, you know, people will overstep. Just you know how it gets online. You know, it's not necessarily, they don't have, you know, bad intentions. It's just, it's hard to like have hardcore boundaries online. So my website is a way of mitigating that, to where you only contact me through the submission form, like if you're really serious. Cause I know only people who want to seriously contact me are on my website, you know, and not like in my Twitter DM, for example.
And so also, how does it feel I saw on Twitter that you're a big fan of like Deep Fantasy by Surfing.
Yes.
And how do you think that Vaporwave has had an influence on your style of music?
Yo, Vaporwave is so, okay. I think it's so interesting because on one hand it's like really cringy. It could be like this weird, like techno orientalist, you know, fetishy genre. But then when you get good Vaporwave, it's like, yes. It's like everything you love about the internet and everything you love about, you know, chop samples is just all in one place. You get this really nice little group of electronic music. I think Vaporwave is like, it kind of bleeds into the, you know, the Y2K trend that's happening now. Which I guess I'm kind of a part of. I feel like it's mostly a visual trend though lately. Well, not I wouldn't even say it's a trend, because I think the people who are invested in Y2K aesthetics in the current contemporary moment are like people who appreciate it as like a mode of art making and not just as like a fad or whatever. So like we have this resurgence of a certain We have this resurgence of a certain visual language, right, with the Y2K stuff. And we have a similar resurgence in music with like Plunderphonics and Vaporwave stuff. And that's kind of where I fit in. Like I'm using similar methods of art making when it comes to sound, like these really washed over synths and analog synths and stuff like that, and chopping samples using Japanese pop samples and stuff like that. We all have the same tools, but the way we use them is I feel like definitely indebted to early 2000 stuff and mid 2000 stuff, and you can see that both in the visual design and the sound. It's pretty cool. Vaporwave is cool. Like, I don't care what anybody says. It's cringy, it's corny, but sometimes it's really cool and I like it.
No, like just the other day I listened to Deep Fantasy and I was like, holy shit, like this
It's
is
so
really
good. Deep Fantasy is so good. Like sometimes like I'll open Ableton, I'm like, okay, I have to make something like Moonlight right now. And if I don't, I'm gonna die. And I can never
amazing.
do it. It's too good.
No, exactly. Oh, also, this is like completely like a side note. Because I know you said on like Twitter that you want to have it on wax, and allegedly, what's it called? I think Turntable Lab might be doing a repress. I don't know. I don't know. Just it's a rumor, but
Okay, I'll be on the lookout for it. I'll be on the lookout for it.
And speaking of Twitter, like you say, quite like connected with your fan base through social media and like live streaming on Twitch too. Like, why do you think it's so important to like maintain that relationship with your supporters?
Because those are people who are giving you money, you know? Like, I don't wanna boil it down to just, I wanna like be nice to people who give me money. But sometimes that is what it comes down to. Like, if you want to continue being successful, you have to engage with the people you care about. And I do care about my community. I care about my fans. I care about them outside of music. Like, I want to establish a community that I can uplift whether I'm making music or not. So even if I'm not Twitch streaming, even if I'm not making music anymore, I would still be doing things I think that would enrich my community. And that comes down to like education stuff, sharing resources, and sharing money. That's pretty much the only thing the average person can do, unless you're in a place of political power. You can only do so much, but what you can do, you should do, So I try to do that. If I can provide joy by streaming on Twitch and I have the time and energy to do it, then I'll do it. If I have the time and energy to make music, then I'll do it. If I have the time and energy to share resources and read articles or write articles, then I'll do it. And that's really what it all comes down to. I'm not a very I wouldn't say I'm like, okay, in college, I guess I was like super social, but like as I've gotten older, I'm definitely more of a homebody. I'm not like people, it's always funny when people are like, dude, how come you aren't famous? I'm like, I don't have much star power, dude. I'm awkward. Everything, this shit makes me anxious. Everything makes me anxious. I'm always nervous. Like, I'm not the type of guy who like, I don't know, go up and randomly talk to people. I'm a pretty reserved person. Except like online, I guess, when like on Twitter, but that doesn't even really count. That's not even real interaction. Yeah, like in person, I feel like I'm so different. I'm so reserved. And I'm perfectly okay with that. So I feel like I've been able to engage with my community so well though, because that's one boundary I have been able to set. Like, my social boundaries online, I think, are really good. Like, I don't get in no drama. I don't really care about much of the stuff that really happens on the TL. I'm kind of in my own lane, and I stay in my own lane. I like being in my own lane and hanging out with the people who just so happen to be in the same lane as me. And it's just chill. I just like chilling. I don't want to do anything that's not chilling.
And in sort of like that respect, how do you decide that you want to work with someone and that they're like a good fit for your music?
It's hard because I really don't like working with people, and not anything. It's not because of anything they do. It's usually just I think that I'm a hard person to work with, even though I don't think anybody I've worked with would say that. Like, it's because I don't communicate that well. In my head, I'm like, yo, I was like, I'll think through 100 reasons like why this probably won't work out, and I'm like, nah, bro, I ain't got no beats. If somebody asks, I'm like, yo, you got any beats? I'm like, nah, I ain't got none. No one damn well, I got like 20 beats, but in my head, I'm like, nah, I don't really think this is gonna work out. This is not, I don't know. It's hard. It's tricky because when I make music, I don't make music envisioning another person on the track. So the only time I've ever done that is when I made Malware. It's because I was like, I know I'm gonna get Chris on the track, I know I'm gonna get Vision on the track, and I know I'm gonna get my homie Justin on the track. And once I had that set in stone in my mind, I was like, okay, those were the only three times where I sat down and actually made a beat with somebody else in mind. But on a day-to-day basis, like, even though I want to work with Earl so bad, but I've never sat, yeah, you know, but I've never sat down and been like, I'm gonna make this beat for Earl. You know, like even when I get people pay me to, even when people pay me to make beats for them, I'm still never really thinking. It sounds kind of like douchey to say out loud, but it's kind of true. Like I'm never really thinking of the person I'm making a beat for. It's all like, damn, like, okay, if I can tick off their criteria, fine. But the rest of it is gonna be all me. Like this is all, and I think that's what gives it so much character though, is that I've never tried to do any sound that's not me. Like is always, because at the end of the day, I'm the one who has to make it, you know, and I'm the one who has to attach my name to it. So when I think of that level of responsibility, like it just makes it hard for me to reach out to people and collaborate, except when I get excited about doing remixes. Like remixes, I feel like don't count because like those songs already exist and I can just, you know, I can just put my own spin on it. But when it comes to like real deal collaborating, it's like, yo, this is, because like in my head, I'm thinking this is something that is going to stand the test of time, whether I like it or not. You know, like if it's good, it'll be lauded and celebrated forever. And if it's bad, you know, it's going to suck. And it's going to be remembered for that reason. Or we'll have to, at some point in our future, we'll have to look back and say, ah, that song kind of sucked. And I want to avoid that if at all possible. So I don't know. Collaborations, I feel like it's a lot of responsibility. And I feel like it's something I'll get, like, I feel like I'll get over it once I get like older and like I've been a musician for longer, but I think it's mostly because I'm such a beginner still, you know. Like I have that beginner's pride where it's like, no, everything's mine and I'm doing it on my own, you know. So it's like
And
one of
you
those
like wanted
things.
to be like perfectionist.
Exactly, exactly. At my core, I'm a perfectionist, and I don't want to like put my perfectionist pressure onto anybody else. So even when like me and Chris did the McFly EP, like that was so natural, but it's because I knew him already, and like I knew what he, like in my head I knew what he was gonna do on the beats already, so I didn't even have to like say anything. I just had to send the beats, get them back, mix and master, boom, like that simple. I wouldn't even say that was a, like in my head it didn't even really feel like a collaboration, because it's not like we were in the studio together making it together. It's just like, no, nah, I'm gonna send you these crazy beats and you can do your little crazy thing over and we're gonna have a crazy EP, and that was it. When I think of true collaboration, I think of like being in a shared space and sharing ideas back and forth. And just that in itself is like such a taxing, like in terms of energy, it's like such a taxing activity. Like even when I'm with my friends, like sharing ideas, like, you know, that's like just not easy. You know, articulating yourself and trying to articulate what you want from somebody else, it's a delicate process, and it's also very hard to do because of like, you know, the limits of language. So I tend to stay away from it whenever I can. It's so hard, it's so difficult, but it's something you get better at once as you become a better musician, I think. And it's just part of the learning process. I just have to learn to be a better collaborator, I think.
And I know you just like mentioned Chris, but like in terms of him slash like Iced Out Omnitrix, like whatever you want to call him, how did that relationship kind of develop?
It's kind of funny thinking back because I don't even remember when we became mutuals. Like we became mutuals on my old account before I got suspended. And then I think I definitely I started making music first, I think. I know he started making music before me actually, but I started making music seriously first, I think. And then like I saw him like posting the new stuff he was making on Twitter. I was like, okay, Chris, like I could see him, like, he was doing it for fun. And I was like, ah, oh, I gotta get him on some of my beats first. I wanna be the first person to do a full project with Chris. I wanna be the first one to get him on some beats. And so after he put like two of his singles on Spotify or something, I was like, yo, I'm gonna send you a bunch of beats and let's just do a thing. And it just happened. It happened over the span of like 2 or 3 weeks. Like I sent him one beat and then he finished it the next day. I sent him another beat, he finished it in the next 2 days. I was like, okay, I'm gonna just send you four more and then whenever you finish them, just send them back. And then we ended up with the EP and then it was that simple. It was like one of those things where like, it's the same thing that happened with me and RX Nephew. Like I did not expect to make three songs with him. I woke up one day, my friend told me he was doing $50 verses. I was like, okay, let's just do three songs with RX Nephew. And then it ended up on Pitchfork. And I was like, oh, that's crazy.
Going up.
It's the shit like that that you don't really expect to happen. That just happens naturally and it feels really good. So working with Chris was just on a whim. Just homies, just, you know, sending beats for homies. And things worked out really nicely.
And wait, you also just like touched on this and I'm like kind of curious, and I'm pretty curious actually. Mm-hmm. How'd your last account get suspended?
Oh, I got suspended for being mean to Bernie Sanders. But it was because like he had said something and it was just, I think it was something where like he was speaking on a situation where it was like a black woman or a black person that was a victim of police brutality. And he said something kind of snarky. It was like, when somebody asked him like, what would you tell your child on avoiding police brutality or something? He was like, I would just tell them to follow directions so they don't get, I don't know. I can't remember exactly what he said, but he said something that I felt was insensitive about the way, like about how you should respond to a police officer when you're at risk of violence from the officer that I didn't like. And so I was like, I don't know. I said something stupid. And then I got suspended.
I mean, it's not even like really his place to even like say that.
Right. And that's how I felt. Like, you know, I don't dislike Bernie Sanders, but you know, I don't like him either. So I mean, I don't like any politician. So yeah. I didn't really, I don't know. It was just funny. I think it's funny to tell people because people are always like, oh, so you like hate Bernie Sanders. I'm like, so who'd you, and they're like, who'd you vote for? I'm like, oh brother, let's not. First of all, I didn't vote. So let's. But you know, I don't know. It was just stupid. You know, just stupid Twitter shit. I guess. But it happens.
And so, like, how does it feel to be a black house artist right now? As thinking about like the gentrification of the genre over the past few decades, with predominantly like white European artists mm-hmm. breaking through.
I feel good, but at the same time, like I find myself upset a lot, like. Not necessarily upset with like on a personal, like with an individual, more so that's like, yo, like there are so many white people making mediocre house music and there's so many black people making really good house music. Like, what is the disconnect? Like, what is going on? Like, how do we like, essentially it comes down to how do black people make money from this? We're the ones who started. How do we get back to where, how do we get back to the position of being in control of this genre? And when I say that, I don't mean like, how do we gatekeep it from other people? But like there's a certain amount of homage due, you know? Like when I see Mixmag posting like their best new mixes, their best new song, and it's like a bunch of white guys, I'm like, yo, like I feel kind of snubbed, you know? I feel like, I don't know. I feel like maybe it's kind of egotistical for me to say this, but I feel like I'm not giving my due credit. I feel like I'm not giving my due, like me and my peers. I feel like my peers and I aren't giving our due credit. And I feel like that's what makes me upset the most, because I know we're doing some real like cutting edge house music, and like I know that for a fact. And so like it's just frustrating to like, it's just the classic musician, like mm-hmm. classic underground musician scenario. Like, how do I maintain my underground integrity but still like we have to make a living from this? Like, we got to get paid regardless. Mm-hmm. So like, how do we get society at large to love black house music again? And that, like, when I think about it, it's just that's gonna be such a like, it's gonna be like a decade long struggle, you know? We have to wait for the music trends to cycle back around, and we have to maintain our underground presence and maintain our community presence, and it's just a lot of work to do. But it's not like a hopeless amount of work, you know? It's a hopeful amount of work. You know, it's work that you want to do. So I don't know, being black and making house music right now, I think is definitely important. I feel like this is like the one time where like, not the one time, but this is the time where like we can have this resurgence in a specific Black drama, that could also happen for other Black dramas. Like, I want to see the same thing happen to Jazz. You know, like, Jazz has been, like, throughout time has been, like, run through the mud. Like, they threw Jazz under the bus, even to the point where, like, now Black people have this perspective of Jazz as being, like, something either one for old people or for old white people. And I'm like, no, Jazz is cool. It's cool. Yeah. Like, you know, like, Jazz bands are sick. Like, how do we rebrand Jazz to be, like, the hip Black young thing? Because Jazz is sick. You know, I feel the same way about techno and house. Like, everybody's like, oh, that's, like, the weird white people who do drugs in Germany. I'm like, okay, that's part of it. But also, like,
you know. Yeah, no, there's, like, roots.
Yeah, you know, like, there's Black Detroit. That's all of Detroit. Detroit is literally right there, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So it's, like, how... it's this big re-education process or reappreciation process. And it's just like, how do you kickstart that? You know, how do I, what's my role in the kickstarting of the resurgence of house music? It's fun. It's fun to see how it all pans out though. Cause part of me is like, I know that it's going to eventually going to cross back over into pop, you know, but like, I'm okay with that. Like, I hate pop music, but it's not going to stop me from like appreciating what pop music is on a social level. I think even if I dislike it as a cog in the industry, there's still like, you know, pop music brings a lot of people happiness. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see Black house music have that same type of power in the industry. I think that's what's lacking. That's what, oh, it all comes down to that. It's a power dynamic thing. It's always a power dynamic thing. And like, ooh, it feels so crazy to like figure out like, how can we cause the shift of power to where we are the ones who are controlling the narrative of house music? That's what it really comes down to. Like, it's not even about, I just realized it as I'm talking about, it's not even about like making the money no more or like the recognition. It's just like, I, as a Black person, I want to be part of the group of people who control the narrative of house music.
Yeah.
And like, how it's perceived both now and throughout the rest of time. And that is like, that's the responsibility I want to be a part of and have my peers be a part of as well. So I don't know. We'll see how things unfold.
Mm-hmm. It's happening.
Yeah, it's so crazy.
Yeah. And this like sort of like maneuvers like towards the next question. And like your last few projects have taken more of a route of like repurposing and refamiliarizing your fans with like disco music and its root in Black culture. Now, do you think your art is like educational in that sense?
Ooh, I never thought about it like that, but I sure hope so. I hope that somewhere a 14, 16-year-old Black kid is learning about disco music because of me. If so, that would be crazy. But you're right, though. That's something I didn't even really notice for myself until recently. Like, I've been doing a lot of, like, I've been learning a lot from the old masters lately. Like, I've listened to a lot of jazz, listened to a lot of blues and funk, and just, like, it's like it all comes down to me. It all comes back to like, how can I make this a dance track? Everything I hear, I was like, okay, how can I make this a dance track? And like, I've just been playing around with like the blues minor scales lately when I'm making tracks. I'm like, yo, this is kind of crazy. You know, blues and funk is kind of crazy. Like once you strip away, when you strip away the guitar and you just have the keys and drums left, funk is not you know like folk, like the good folk funk music like from like the 60s. It's like once you strip away the guitar, because the guitar is kind of twangy, you know, it gives it that classic like blues blues folk sound. Once you take that out and you just have the keys and the drums, it's only, you know, two or three steps away from contemporary jazz. Yeah. And then jazz is only a couple simplifications away from being deep house music, you know. Mm-hmm. So once I start thinking of it like that, it's like, oh man, like there's a world of language in between funk, jazz and deep house, and it's just like, oh, and like being able to navigate that as a producer, I think I hopefully, like, if I'm able to do it successfully, hopefully that will be an educational experience, because it's also like, ooh, it's like you learn so much about, or you realize so much about Black history through the roots of the music. Like when I look at how the scales have been treated throughout time by Black musicians, and then like the narratives that they were trying to tell through their music, and how that formed the way that they engage with the basic tools of music making, it's just all like, it's so hard to articulate, but like you just get, like everything just clicks, you know. It just clicks into place. Like when I think about how how jazz was created and think about how funk was and the blues were created, like, and just the traditions of Black oration and storytelling, and then how the music accompanies that storytelling, and then it becomes really abstract, and you take away the words and you make it really abstract, and then you get jazz, and you simplify the jazz and add some words, and you get deep house, and it's like, oh, it's so crazy.
It's like all connected.
Yeah, it's so connected. And like, yeah, I think realizing those connections and building on those connections is the way we can make our music both like the word I wanted to say was more complicated, but it doesn't even have to be more complicated. Just more connected. Yeah, like once we start bridging, like once we move like post-genre music is going to be so, post-genre Black music is going to be so crazy. And I can't wait to see like my, like what I would want from my career would be for somebody from the younger generation, like a 13 or 14 year old Black kid, to grow up and start making weird pop music, and then say, you know what, I learned about disco because I was listening to Dirty Bird. Would make me so happy. Would
see your influence, like see like people taking from it and like creating something like completely new.
Exactly, which would be funny because it's like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I don't know anything about music, you know, like on a theory level. Like I'm still a beginner. Like I just started learning the piano like 2 weeks ago, you know. So like to see that this is my strength even as a beginner, it's like, it's like I have so much to learn. And then once I learn more, I can teach others more effectively. And I think that's, yeah. Hopefully, I hope that somebody out there is learning from my music because I'm also learning as I'm making it.
You took down like all of your pre Sounds of Life music from like streaming services like a few weeks ago. Like, what was the intention behind that?
Because I think it all sucks now. Like, it wasn't anything special. I just didn't like it anymore. And when I think about how I want people to engage with my discography for the first time, I wouldn't want it to be. I don't think I would want it to start with AV Club, even though that was my first album. I think. Controlling how people engage with my music for the first time is important to me. So if that means I have to limit what they can access at first, then so be it. You know, like I want to be able to, like, it just comes down to the narrative. I want to be able to control my own narrative when it comes to how my music is being received. Because what I would hate is what I don't want to happen is like for somebody to like imagine like they go on my Spotify profile and the first thing they listen to is AV Club. I'm like, no, like, cause you can't even fully appreciate that until you've heard the new stuff, you know. Like, you gotta hear the best stuff first, and then you'll be like, okay, I can see how he was learning over time, and then, you know. So I want to be able to have that kind of, I want to be able to control, I'm a control freak. I want to be able to control as much as I can how people engage with my music. And if that means taking out all my old shit, then so be it. Cause I don't want them to hear the bad stuff first. You gotta hear all the good stuff first to appreciate it.
Some good stuff though. It's like, I love my girlfriend. Like I was like sad when I saw that. I was like, oh.
So funny, because like now what I'm struggling with now is that I feel like my old music has so much character. It has so much character. I'm like, oh man. And you know why? It's because I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. And now I've gotten into the part where like, I feel like I kind of know what I'm doing. So when I open Ableton, like I kind of have like a schematic in my head for how I want to make a song. But when I didn't have that, I was just doing whatever I wanted to. And so now I'm at a point where like, you know, it's that thing where like the man who thinks he knows everything knows nothing. And it's like, I think I know something now, but it's like, it's put me into a place where I've created a box for myself. Whereas previously I didn't have a box. So now it's like, damn, now I gotta figure out how to take the fucking box off again. You know, like I gotta figure out how to get out of the genre cage that I put myself in for some reason. But no, it's just, it's fun. It's been a fun thing to learn and unlearn and then to teach yourself something new. Like I feel like my old music taught me, like I learned so much about, just like, I don't know, there's so much I have to learn music theory if I want to get better. And so that's where I am now. But some days I wake up and I like listen to my old stuff. I'm like, yo, this is not quite as good as what I'm doing now. But if I took the skills that I have now and remade the song, it would be so much better. So it's fun to see. It's fun learning from my old music. It's still teaching me stuff, which I think is valuable.
Yeah. And have you ever thought about like making the complete transition to becoming a musician who solely sells their work on Bandcamp and their own website?
Yes. That's something I'm also navigating right now with my next project. Like, I want it to be like I want stuff to be on streaming just for access, right? Just for new listeners. Because I do realize streaming has a big impact on the discovery of new artists. But at the same time, I feel like I'm at a part in my life where like I can be okay without it. If I will it into being, you know, if I just do it, I feel like I'll be okay. But at the same time, I do realize the advantages of streaming. It's hard because, you know, like I want to be able to make enough money to live,
Yeah,
man. You know,
exactly.
like streaming sucks,
Not like
but it's
$7,000
so
per million
convenient.
streams.
Yeah. So like, I don't know. I figure I'll do a couple of vinyl and CD only releases, and then like after they've been out for a while, I'll just put it on streaming. Because you know, it doesn't hurt to have stuff on streaming. It's just annoying to know that you're not making as much money off it as you could. So maybe I feel like, but like I feel like as long as you're upfront with your audience about why you're doing what you're doing, it won't matter. You know, like if I say, you know, I'm do this vinyl only and CD only. But I'm gonna put it up on streaming later. But the reason I'm doing this is because I'm not gonna get paid unless I do it this way. You know,
No.
having that clear communication, it makes it so that the media that you choose to release your music on doesn't really matter. Because as long as you're controlling what your audience expects from you, it doesn't really matter how you put out your music, I
Yeah.
think.
I mean, like, there also like so many like different approaches people have like been looking into. Like, I know like some people do like a standard LP, and then they'll do like a collector's edition where it's like the vinyl's colored and all that, and that's like a different price point, and it's also on streaming, so it's just like levels to how much you want to like support the artist too.
Exactly. And it's like I think it's so funny when people are like people always argue on Twitter about like when you're a beginning artist, like should you just put out a single and then an album? Should you just put out an album first? I'm like, yo, nobody
Yeah,
cares. Like nobody gives a
exactly.
fuck, you know?
No,
Like
yeah.
just do what you want to do. Establish your expectations from your audience from the beginning, and then it won't matter later. You know, like everybody knows I put out music whenever I feel like it. So nobody expects me to put out an album once a month or once every 3 months or once a year. Like nobody really expects anything from me because they expect me to do what I want to do. You know, so like once you establish that, it doesn't really matter what you do anymore. Like, you can. I don't know. Audiences, like, much, I feel like I'm privileged. I have this kind of privilege because I don't have a huge audience. You know, I have kind of this cult following where I control my boundaries and my engagement with my music and my audience to a really fine level. I feel like once you like start getting like that, like hundreds of thousands of monthly listeners, that kind of
It
it
like
kind
changes
of becomes out of your reach. You can't really control ooh, how people engage with the music. That's gonna be so crazy. I don't know how I'm gonna navigate that if I get more popular.
It's gonna happen. It's
But
manifesting.
it's something, you know, a bridge is a bridge you cross when you see it.
And something that I found like to be quite interesting about you is like you're a crate digger, like buying a lot of like vinyl lots from eBay, utilizing like Discogs to grab some like 12 inches or like obscure albums to like chop up and sample for like projects and live streams. Now, how has crate digging helped you grow as an artist?
Ooh, it's exposed me to like so many different, so much music that like I wouldn't have heard otherwise. Like when I think about the long, like how long streaming has been around, how long online music is just as a thing has been around. It's like, oh, like analog media, like music on analog media has been along way longer. Like there's so many bands who have put out music on vinyl that never became popular, and so now there's just hundreds of these vinyl records just laying around that nobody's listening to. Like when I think about that, you know, it's like there must be like this endless amount of music that I just haven't heard from these average people who just were able to put out their one song on vinyl one time, you know, and it was never a hit. So like when I think about like finding music like that, that makes it really fun because it adds like adds a different appreciation to it when you know that it wasn't a widespread release, or it wasn't something that, you know, it wasn't super popular. And not from like a hipster standpoint. It was like, oh, I'm listening to music that nobody's listened to before. Like, okay. Like that's part of it too. Like that's fun too. But like to be able to appreciate another person's effort throughout time in that way through vinyl is like That's where I get the joy from, is knowing that, like, in 1999, these two black guys put out this weird-ass dance record. And even though it's not on streaming no more, here I am, like, playing it again in my house. And, like, that's, like, it's just, like, the cycle of the narrative. Like, again, like, reappreciating people's music throughout time. Vinyl was one of the best ways to do that. Because you still have access to all these limited releases or not so popular releases that allow you to appreciate another person's work throughout time in a way that's not just, I don't know, you can't do that. You can't really get the same effect on streaming, you know? Because if for something to end up on streaming, that means it has to have passed hands through somebody with enough power to do that, you know? Like, even like when I was first like learning how to put my music on streaming, I was like, damn, it's low key a lot of hoops you gotta jump through to get your music on streaming, right? So when I think about all the people who didn't have that kind of industry support, who are making music and were pressing it on, like, pressing it on wax or like burning bootleg CDs, like, there's so much music. There's so much music that didn't pass through the power hands to get to the masses, you know? So I don't know. It's cool to see the efforts of people who weren't superstars and learning from their work.
Yeah. And I guess, like, as a collector myself, like, I guess the question always have to, like, ask is, like, what's your favorite record in your collection?
Oh, I don't know. My favorite record. Oh, fuck. Okay. I'm gonna nail it. I'm gonna trim it down to five, maybe. Okay. So I would say, oh, actually, that's a lie. Okay. I'm gonna trim it down to like 20. So 1 through 10 would probably be like, 1 through 12 actually would probably be like every Moody Man vinyl that I have. I love all those equally. All the Moody Man projects equally. They're all my precious treasures. But out of those, Black Mahogany. So out of those first 12, Black Mahogany is definitely number one. That's my favorite record. I think that's my favorite record. Because it's my favorite album. The record is beautiful. And I got this, you know, he got this one, like, each, I think the release had like 3 or 4 different B-sides on the last record. So it's like a 4-disc pack. And the 4th disc, there's versions of it with different B-sides. And once I find it out, I was like, oh, that's so cool. Black Mahogany, I would think Black Mahogany, then there's like the rest of my Moody Man records. And there's the original, I have an original pressing of Jimi Hendrix's Electric Ladyland.
Whoa.
And it's stamped by some rich guy who used to live in New York. I looked him up. I couldn't really find much about him, but I knew that his family was super rich. First pressing of Electric Ladyland. And then, probably some rap songs, honestly. Just because the album means a lot to me. So to have it on wax is like, for me, it's just like, it's that same feeling of like having your grandpa show you his favorite record. Like, I can't wait to do that 40 years from now. I cannot wait. Like, even though it's still, like, the album's still going to be on streaming probably, or, like, whatever system we used to listen to music for years. But the fact that I can still do what all the old heads do and pull out SRS on vinyl and put it on an old-ass turntable and, like, this is what music is.
Oh my God.
The fact that I can do that is a big source of joy for me. So, yeah. Black Mahogany, the rest of the Woody Man catalog, Electric Ladyland, and SRS. Those are my favorite records.
That like completely resonates with me, because I picked up like recently like Back from the Dead 2 by like Chief Keef, and I like, I'm dreaming of just like showing my kids like, oh, come here, check out Finita.
I would probably cry, dude. Like, I have DJ Screw All Screwed Up on vinyl too, and like, I've been thinking the same thing. Like, it's like genres of music that you wouldn't expect people to play on vinyl. It's so funny because you know, she's throwing some wax and it's Back from the Dead 2. That's so funny. But I totally get it.
It's an essential at this point. But can you walk me through the genesis of Time Traveler? Since it's completely like distinct from your discography, especially with its incorporation of like 2000s era electronica and its reimagination of like disco house music.
Ooh, Time Traveler is fun. It was the first time where I was like, I want to make a... No, it's not the first time. That's a lot. But the practice albums were Brainworks and Malware, where I was practicing incorporating a narrative into my music. Time Traveler is like the time where like I was finally able to to make the narrative obvious and make it consistent and coherent throughout the whole album. It was also my first true concept album where the concept behind it is evident in the music, I think. For Brainworks and Malware, those are both concept albums to me, but because I didn't make the narrative that known to my audience, it doesn't really count. It doesn't really quite count as a concept album if both parties aren't aware that it's a concept album. You feel me? Mm-hmm. So like with Time Travelers, like people are aware and I am also aware of what I was doing. So it's to me, it's cemented as a concept album. Mm-hmm. It started, I wanted to show the progression of Black music from the 70s up until the 2070s in my head. So it was fun to it's funny because the way that, honestly, if I could go back, I would trim probably two or three songs. I'll make it two or three songs shorter just because I feel like it's such a long album. And it's hard to hold people's attention with electronic music for that long unless it's like a masterpiece, you know? And I know that Time Travel is not a masterpiece, but I still like it, but I feel like if I had trimmed it a couple songs, it would have been a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. I made the track list originally was 8 or 9 songs, and it was mostly from the first half of that album. So everything up until Captain's Log, and then I had 2 or 3 songs that I ended up not making the cut. So the tone of the album was so different because it was mostly disco house and a little bit of mid-2000s electronic style stuff. And then once I finished Captain's Log and finished a couple of other songs, I was like, yeah, let's just make this a whole experience. Like, let's do a music video. Let's do CDs. Let's do wax. Let's do everything that I could possibly think of doing with the album. Time Travel is definitely the album with the most merch, with the most collaborators, the most songs. It has like the most everything. It's like my deluxe. It's like my deluxe album. Time Travel is crazy. It's funny, because I didn't anticipate it being such a big deal, I guess, in my discography. Like, I knew, actually, no, that's a lie. I thought Time Travel was going to be, like, my pop album. Like, the one that's, like, when you think of my name, you think of Time Travel, right? Yeah. But I feel like that would be, like, impossible for me to do because I just have so much music, you know? Like, I don't think I'll ever have an album that's just, like, that when you think of me, you think of this album because I just have too many. That was fun. The music video is still in the process. That should be coming out soon. And I think once that comes out, then the narrative will make even more sense. Because it's kind of loose right now, right? You just kind of feel the narrative. Like, you can feel the time shifting with the music. But with the music video, it makes it a lot more. It's character driven. Yeah. So then it makes the album itself more character driven. You have somebody to follow. Throughout the narrative, because right now I feel like when you listen to it, it's not really like you're following a character per se, but you're experiencing a shift throughout time as you listen to the music, which is cool in its own way. But once the music video comes out and becomes more character driven, I feel like it'll bring the album back to the forefront of my audience's mind again, and then everything will click into place. So I'm excited. Time Travel is fun. I feel like I could have done better in certain areas, but tracks felt so good. So that's crazy.
That's probably my favorite song of yours. It's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah. That's the power of Disco House, man. Somebody was telling me that they played the song and they were trying to Shazam it and they couldn't get the sample. I was like, perfect. That's perfect. That's so perfect. That's how I know that I've done my job. Because the song itself, from 1978, the song is called "Dance Turned Into a Romance." But I forget who the artist is. It's a group of women singers. The song itself, I feel like, it's not like a classic disco song, but I don't know, it was just fun to remix. Felt So Good is crazy. Captain Vlog is crazy. What You Need is crazy. Crazy Sexy Techno song. Nobody's doing Crazy Sexy Techno anymore, so I had to do that for the one time. It was fun. I got a bunch of homies to co-produce. I got Days on the last track. I got Harrison and Cole with a Chris on Gums Groove. The Gums Groove is crazy. Like, I'm so proud of that song because I'm so happy to be able to get my friends who can play instruments on a song, and then my contribution was the drums. Basically, I did all the drum programming, which is cool. So it was cool to feel like I was in a band for the first time. Playing with my homies playing the instruments, they're doing their little things. I'm pressing buttons on the drum machine. It felt good. So Time Travel was fun. I think it was a big learning experience. I learned a lot about my process. And hopefully when the music video comes out, everybody will be excited about it again and listen to Time Travel one more time.
And but in regards to like Neurogenesis, like what pushed you to release a sequel to Brainworks?
It just made sense because the music I was making at the time was just so. I feel like when I made Mizu, I think Mizu was the first track off Neurogenesis that I made. After I made that, I was like, this song is crazy. No, that's a lie. I made Cars 2 first.
Yeah,
After I
the
finished Cars
single
2,
and
I
it
was like,
dropped.
yo, this is crazy. Like, and what made me realize that it was gonna be a sequel to Brainworks was that it gave me that same feeling of like my brain fucking exploding. And I was like, you know what? You know what other album of mine did this? Brainworks. This has to be a sequel. Cause like what links them together for me is the last track on Brainworks, Untitled. Because it's like has no drums. It's just a weird loop, weird sample. But it makes my brain active in that same way. And I was like, oh, I wanna make something that has that same feeling, but just do it better, just execute it better. Because some of the tracks like on Brainworks that were really sample heavy, like New Drug and It Doesn't Matter, they're good songs, I feel like, but the arrangement could have been more exciting. But it's crazy because like on one hand, like when you have songs that just loop forever, on one hand you love it because you can just sit in the loop for as long as you want to, and it's great. But on the other hand, it's like, okay, if I change the arrangement, maybe it could be more exciting. But it benefits. The reason it's a good song is because it's not exciting. So you get that kind of, it's kind of a conflict. It's kind of hard to decide between making a good relaxed song or a good exciting arrangement song. So with Neurogenesis, I want to like get better at arranging house music to make it more engaging. I think I did a good job. It's just as cool. It's a good sequel. Good
Just
sequel to a good album.
like an upbeat version of like the more down tempo like Brainworks.
Exactly. It's just a little bit more active, a little bit more exciting. Whereas Brainworks is definitely a lot more chill. Yeah, Brainworks is like it's like being in like those like this like sense deprivation tanks, and then Neurogenesis is like getting an MRI scan and it goes wrong.
Yes. Yes. And I guess my next question would be, what do you consider to be your greatest accomplishment so far?
Ooh, my biggest accomplishment so far, probably the NTS mix. NTS mix is just something I wanted for so long, like, and to finally be able to do it. And to, no, that's a, oh, it's hard because the NTS mix and my Block FM Japan mix, those two are probably my biggest achievements because like they're international in scale, and they're both things I've always really wanted to do since I first started making music. Like, I love NTS. I wanted to do an NTS mix so bad. To finally be able to give me the chance to do one as a guest on somebody's show was just like a dream come true. And then I followed it up with the Block FM mix. And I was just like, oh man, life is so good. I'm playing on a radio station in Japan. I'm playing all my weird house music. And
That's
it
so
just felt
sick.
so good. So yeah, I think those two. Because I feel like to be recognized on an international scale, like as just like some random kid from North Carolina, is just like, I don't know. It's just like, to be able to tell like other young Black kids that I was appreciated internationally for my personal appreciation of house music, to like to be able to do that on an international scale is like, oh man, like what more could you ask for, you know? So those two definitely.
And who have you found to be your greatest inspiration, both artistically and personally?
All of the DigiCore kids, Quinn, Dolly, Days, Reagan, like all the Eric BOA, Glaive, all this, like the kids are so good, dude. Like all the young kids are so good. They keep me like they make me like keep grinding. Like I see the stuff they're doing. They're so talented and they're so like they have their sound like really, really like it's like they have their sound like not simplified, but like they've gotten to the core of the essence of their music really quickly. And like that's something that usually takes like ours years to develop. But they like hop that gate, like this is what my sound sounds like. This is what, you know, this is what my brand's gonna look like. And it's all like really articulate, like from the jump. And I'm like, damn, that's pretty commendable. And I don't know, just to see them grow on like such a on the world stage, you know, because they all have like 10 times as many monthly listeners as me. Mm-hmm. So like to see them, I'm like, yeah, y'all are growing on a mm-hmm. on like a nationwide scale. To, you know, to have all these people witness you get better over time, it's like mm-hmm. it's pretty cool. It inspires me to keep grinding and to keep doing my little weird thing. Mm-hmm. Especially when they reach out to me like, yo, I love your music. I'm like, really?
This is an honor.
I feel like the big homie. Like, it's like it's funny when your little homies doing better than you, but mm-hmm. they're still like, yo, I love your music. I'm like, appreciate that, thank man. You know, it feels good to know that I'm doing. It feels good to know that I feel like I'm so in my own lane sometimes. So we're like, I don't really know how people from other lanes are like viewing my music because mm-hmm. like I don't really listen to that much new music either. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm always listening to like 80s and 90s stuff. I'm always like listening to records, you know, or like looking for old music to play on stream. Mm-hmm. So like I never really get the chance to like sit down and actually listen to new music that's coming out. Mm-hmm. So to know that new artists who are bursting onto the scene are also listening to my music, it makes me feel really cool. And it makes me want to keep just makes me want to work harder and just keep growing together. I always tell people that. Like, mm-hmm. when they're like, oh, I love your music. I'm like, yeah, let's keep growing together. You know, it feels good to like be part of a movement in the larger music community where young people are just doing their best and getting better. It feels good.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hoping to accomplish within like the next 5 years?
For the next 5 years, I want to make a real jazz album. Ooh. A real, real deal jazz album with a band. That would be, I might stop making music after that. Like, that would be my peak. Like, if I could put a band together and just really, like, execute all my ideas I have when it comes to, like, composition, like, I'd probably cry afterwards. Like, that would be perfect. Yeah. I could ask for more than that. Like, to put together a real deal quartet and just record, like, a timeless piece of music. Mm-hmm. That's my goal for the next 5 years. Maybe even the next 10 years. Like, that's, like, a life goal for me. Like, to make a jazz album. Because, like, it just means so much to me. Like, when I think about, like, the genealogy of, like, my understanding of music, it all comes back to jazz. I have to make a jazz album. Like, when I think about the Black experience, or just, like, even politically, like, it all comes back to jazz. So, I want to put a band together and just really, flex my knowledge. I want to accumulate the knowledge first and then put together my little band and do my thing and... That would be a big dream come true.
Yeah. I love jazz. It's like probably like my like top three genres. And I'm kind of just like, no matter like what, you always just like find your way back to jazz.
It's
like,
exactly.
And after listening to your latest project, Neurogenesis, what do you hope for people to know about Dirty Bird?
Oof. I want them to know. I want them to know that I'm a student. I'm a student first. Mm-hmm. All right. And not even just like a student of music, like of everything. Mm-hmm. I love picking up new skills. I love learning just in general. Like, I think that's all I want everybody to know about me is that I'm a student first. I'm always open to getting better and learning new things. And that's like a driving force for me, both politically and individually and musically. Like, I just want to get better and help other people get better and improve the general quality of life, you know? It can be as abstract or specific as you want it to when it comes to like just wanting to get better. Like, I want everything to get better. I want to learn more and to understand more, and I think through music I've been able to do that in a way that I didn't expect. Because not only am I learning stuff musically, I'm learning stuff about how to manage myself, about how to manage my relationship to my own labor, how to manage, you know, my relationship with other people, how to, you know, navigate my day-to-day emotions. Like, I've been able to learn so much, and I want to keep being able to do that and making good work alongside that. So I treat all of my releases as like a checkpoint. I'm always learning. I'm always getting better. And this just so happens to be the thing I produced in this moment. And it's the culmination of everything that I've learned since all my other albums. You know, it's always a building block and I'm always learning. And hopefully I always get better. Like, I don't ever want to get to a point where I release something and it's not as good as the thing I released previously. I think everything I've released is better than what I released previously, in my opinion.
I mean, that's like the only opinion that matters, like at the end of the day.
Right. Too. Exactly.
Like you're not trying to impress anybody. You're just like trying to put your art out there and people are gonna appreciate it.
Exactly. I just hope I always feel like that. I hope I always continue to get better. And I'm always in a process of learning.
And yeah, I think that is all my questions. And thank you so much for being so like generous with your time. Like,
yeah, no problem. I'm chilling. I ain't really got shit to do.